Betsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Oh boy, this is fun. I am speaking today to somebody, well, who is writing about one of my favorite subjects, coffee. As a Finlander, Finns drink more coffee than any other country in the world. And for Finns who live in America, most of them live in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, we drink coffee from really, you know, we're about 2 months old and we're sitting on our grandfather's knee and he is putting coffee, a little bit of coffee with lots of milk in a saucer and feeding it to us. So I am so happy to talk to Emmeline Duncan about her new series, and it is going to be, I think it's going to be a real hit, and it's, the book is called Fresh Brewed Murder. Oh, wow. Hi, Emmeline.
Hi, thanks for having me on today.
Wow.
And one thing you might like to know is that I'm part Finnish, and I actually lived in Finland for a year.
Well, I knew I loved you. It's so funny. First of all, to get on this program, actually, all anybody has to do is write a book about coffee. I drink a lot of coffee, and as I said, as you know, in Finland, it's like nonstop. So, wow, this is great. And the book, I enjoy it so much. I think it's terrific. Yeah? You like that? What else do you want me to say?
I also really love my book, and I'm really excited that Kensington picked it up, and now people get to read it across the country.
Yeah, well, when I say terrific, I mean terrific. I enjoyed it on so many levels. Of course, there's a lot of, you know, coffee facts in there, and I love that. And I love a book where I learn something that I don't know. And so I come out at the end, I feel like I'm a winner, you know? And in this case, I won so many things because the storyline is great. I love the characters and you know what I really like? And this shows that you are a very, very clever and intelligent and thoughtful writer. Your main character, she's a barista named Sage Kaplan. And so we start off having to learn, you know, it's always with the first book, you want to sort of get that character out there and get people interested in her. And I love the way that you just gently revealed a little bit about her father, a little bit about her brother. We learned something, but it's all so seamless. It's beautifully written. The first chapter, I thought, well, this is an example of somebody who wants to hook the reader and get them interested in the book.
Yeah, when I was writing, it was a really big deal to me. I came up with a fairly elaborate backstory for my character and a fairly specific timeline, and that also led to her to who she became the person that she is. And so then it was really fun figuring out when writing, like, how to slowly reveal the information to get readers engaged in the story, but also hopefully to fall in love with the character, and for all of her decisions to feel like they were truly grounded in who she is, like, as a person.
Well, you did.
Also, like,
you did.
All of her brother and her father and her friends, like, I wanted all of them to feel like their lives had really brought them to this point in the story where hopefully when people read them, they're like, wow, they feel like they are real living people.
And that's exactly what happened. And it's the premise of the story is that Sage is, you know, starting a new business, something really fantastic, a coffee, what do we call it? A coffee...
What's a roaster?
Roaster.
A
coffee cart. And, of course, the setting is Portland, where people love coffee. And so it's so apropos. And the way also that you write about Portland I found fascinating, because now I've never been to Portland, but I like the way you wrote about it.
Well, I was born in Oregon, and I spent most of my life, other than a year in Finland, here. And it was really big deal to me to try to make the Portland that I know and I love come through in the book. And so, and I live in Portland now. And so I tried to work as much of kind of like a local flavor as possible in. And, you know, food cart pods are a big deal here. And they sort of started out as, like, if there was like an empty lot, it was a way to sort of create a business by creating like a collection of food carts on it as a way to essentially monetize empty space. But it created a really fantastic food culture. And if you go to a food cart pod, you'll meet people that are really passionate about what they do. You know, like there's like a, maybe it's a cart that is waffle. There's a lot of, like there's a really great like Filipino cart. There's a Haitian cart that's phenomenal. And so sometimes they're like, you know, they're immigrants or they're people that have like a really specific focus and it's how they're sharing. Like sometimes it's their culture and they're, you know, creating their own small business.
And sometimes it's just a passion for, you know, if you have a passion for coffee, it's a perfect thing to have a cart and, you know, to sell the coffee that you love. And I like the way you describe the coffee. I like how she, you know, talks about, I just like everything about her.
And my goal with her was to be someone that is a very understanding person. She has a very strong moral code, but she's also forgiving and wants to make the world a better place. But she also doesn't have, you know, blinders on. Like, she's not a total Pollyanna. She has a really strong, she has a very realistic look at the world while also seeing things through a more inspirational lens than cynical.
Well, you know, of course, it's a mystery, and there's going to be a murder. But even that, I think that you brought that in so nicely. So let's say we tell people about the book. You tell me what you want to tell people, because I never like to give away the mystery part of a book. What do you like to tell people?
Well, I usually say Fresh Food Murder. If they want to know the kind of like the category, it's a cozy mystery, but it's a little bit. So a lot of cozy mysteries, or also called traditional mysteries, have like an amateur sleuth, and they tend to be mysteries. There's not a lot of violence on the page. There's not a lot of like sexual content on the page, and so mine fits in that category, but it pushes the boundaries a little bit because it's set in a city and it deals with realistic city issues like gentrification and homelessness. Although I would say the camera lens, it doesn't dwell on those issues, although it hopefully deals with them with sensitivity. And so when I talk about Fresh Food Murder, I usually mention, I kind of sometimes call it a hipster mystery also. And I say it's, you know, there's someone who's starting a food cart pod with her good friend, and when she comes, and there's across the street from her food cart pod, there's a new apartment being built. And she comes to work one day, and she finds the developer of the lot across the street dead by her cart. And then she finds out that her mother, actually, who's a well-known grifter, has a history with this man as well.
So that's a premise for the story. And then from there, it builds up as you. I said, you have a lovely way to reveal things. With just a few sentences, I got the feeling for her brother, for her father, for her friends. And that what I thought that was just done so very, very well. And, of course, we get the fun of the coffee. So how did you get – you obviously love coffee.
I do, and it's sort of funny. I bought my first espresso maker when I was 14. And I played around a lot. I did a little, worked a little bit as a barista in my college days. And it's one of those things, like, I mean, obviously I like it a lot. I've played around a lot with like home roasting. I have at least 10 different ways to brew coffee at home. I live in an area with a lot of micro roasters, and that's given me the ability to go and, you know, and chat with baristas, including some, like, you know, there's barista championships in the world, and we have like a championship barista in Portland, a world champion, or U.S. champions, one of the two. And we have, you know, roasters that have won awards. And one thing I love about going into these, because they tend to be smaller businesses, is the people working there will, if you show interest, will happily talk to you about, you know, what they're doing, you know, and what makes their, you know, blends different or unique. And so, I mean, I feel very lucky in that I did a lot of research, but I also could just, you know, go to coffee shops around town and buy coffee and essentially do research at the same time.
Well, the nice thing about it, as I said, you bring in different types of coffees and you explain them. And I think a lot for a lot of people, you know, it whets their appetite, or you really want to go out and then try a new coffee.
Yeah, that's one nice thing about if you find like a really cool independent coffee shop is if you can ask them, like, what do you have that's unique, or what do you do that's special? You know, because maybe one place specializes in a pour over, but maybe someplace else has, you know, like a clever immersion device that they really like to brew with. And maybe they'll be able to tell you about, like, oh, yeah, these beans come from, like, you know, Central America, and this is the flavor profile, which is different from, like, Ethiopian blends or, you know, beans from Indonesia.
Well, we're lucky here in our area. We have quite a few nice small coffee shops like that, indie coffee shops, where they talk about coffee. They love coffee, and they do, you know, their own roasting, which I think is, well, the smell of coffee, I just love. I wish, I actually don't grind my own coffee anymore. I've gotten too lazy. But it is wonderful to do. And when you were writing, one of the things that I like is at the end of the book, you have recipes, and those were, I just found those delightful.
Yeah, those are really fun to come up with. And I wanted to offer things that would, recipes that people could really use in their own home. And so, you know, like how to make a proper cold brew coffee is really pretty simple once you understand, like, the kind of the ratios of coffee beans to water. And being able to make, like, your own simple syrups where you can do your own, like, home lattes or just, like, a flavored, you know, cold brew, I thought would be a really useful thing for people to walk away with.
And it was a nice little history lesson there in cold brews. Explained where they come from. Suddenly, you know, we started seeing them being served in you know, chain restaurants, but explain where they originally came from.
Well, they're from Japan. Like, Kyoto coffee is what they're usually called. And it, you know, and it is literally to brew coffee without needing hot water. And there's this legend that the Dutch traders brought the practice of making cold brew with them from Indonesia, which is, I think, really fun. But it's definitely been popular in Japan since the 1600s.
Well, and it's only really not for that long. So it's I remember when it first came out, I said, what is that? How do you do that? Because, of course, I grew up with actually, we used a percolator, you know, right on top of a wood stove, because I was from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and we still have wood stoves when I was a kid.
I really like percolators for coffee. I actually have a stovetop and an electric percolator. I think it makes a really kind of fresh-tasting, clean cup.
It does. It does. It's a very special flavor. I love the way it tastes. Now, when you were coming out with the mystery, so as you did some research into murder?
I did. I'm a member of, like, Mr. Right is America and Sisters in Crime, and both of those organizations have different people that work in, like, law enforcement or in, like, medical fields will talk frequently. There's a writer, D.P. Lyle, he's a cardiologist, and he has, like, books on, like, medical forensics out, and I've heard him speak before, and I have some of his books. So I did a lot of research into both the investigative side of murder from, like, the police and on, like, a district attorney sort of level. And then I also, you know, researched a lot on, like, and most of this didn't actually make it in the book, also, like, on the medical side of murder. So I wanted everything to feel authentic, even if, you know, 95% of those details never made it into the manuscript.
Well, but that's part of the fun. It gives you, when you have a lot of research behind you, even though you use a small portion, it somehow it comes through in the writing that there's a depth to your writing.
I think it's important for it to feel accurate, and where as a reader, I think you can tell if someone just winged it and made stuff up. And it's nice to know when you have that sense of, like, okay, they actually have done a lot of research and they know what they're talking about. And I think if you read something that you can tell that doesn't feel authentic, it takes you out of the story, and it makes you question not just that detail, but I think the entire novel.
Well, I think that now this is the first book in this new series, and I assume you're already working on the second one.
The second one is actually it's done. It's going through the publishing process at my at Kensington now, so I'll be getting copy edits sometime this summer. I'm actually starting on book three of the series.
Well, I can see because it's a good. I think the premise is good. The characters are beautifully done, and they're the kind of characters that we will want to we will learn more about as we go along. So I was very impressed. And, of course, it's a Kensington book. And we always know that Kensington, they're just top-notch. And particularly with the covers, this is a lovely cover. It's very, very noticeable.
It's very cheerful with the coffee cart on the front and, like, having, like, a little dog. And one thing that I think it was in the final versions came in the mail. Like, I noticed how the words, like, it says Fresh Fruit Murder, of course, on the cover. If you put them in the light, they sort of reflect the light back. It's amazing.
Yeah, I know. Really cool. They did a beautiful cover. Really great. And I wanted you to say the name of your editor at Kensington, because I love.
So it's John S., and I have heard his last name said before, and I feel really guilty that I honestly can't remember the proper way to say it, and I don't want to.
Oh, I thought you would get it right. Okay, well, I actually should invite him on, and then he can pronounce his name, because I think it looks so beautiful.
I think he'd be a really fun guest. You should.
Yeah, I should. I do have editors on the program sometimes. I've had some very famous editors. And I think maybe I'll invite him just so that he'll pronounce his name for us, because it's such a great name. I think it's so cool. And as I was saying, one of the features, of course, are the recipes in the back. I wanted to mention Oregon French toast because... you mentioned there that in, they use hazelnuts, and Oregonians call them filberts.
They do, and it's pretty amazing. We, being Oregon, grow like 99% of the hazelnuts in the United States. It's obviously other places in the world also grow them, but yeah, it's actually a very big crop here that I think and most people might not know that it's actually we have such a significant hazelnut industry.
Well, I've never had French toast with hazelnuts, and I'm going to do it now because, of course, I've had with pecans or pecans, whichever way you pronounce it, but I think hazelnuts would be just terrific.
Oh, I mean, I like pecans, but I think hazelnuts are really where it's at. They're just such a fantastic, they have such a fantastic flavor.
They do. Well, I thought that was so great. So I think people reading this book, they'll say, whoa, coffee? And this wonderful Oregon, actually, you should have named it after yourself, I think. we should name it after you instead of just the state. French toast, Emmeline's French toast. I think that'd be great, huh? How about that?
For sure. And, if you really want it to feel like as an Oregon recipe, add Marionberry jam.
Oh,
that
wow.
That is really unique.
Wow. Oh, please, people. This is a recipe. You're going to want the book just for that. It's so good. I'm really always so happy when I start off, with the first book in a series. And I did that with another of Kensington's wonderful, wonderful authors, Carol J. Perry. And she was the first guest on my program in the studio. She was the first guest to come in the studio, and that was for her book number one. And now she's up to her 11th book in 6 years, and it's been exciting to watch her career and to watch the development of her series. Because when I started and she had book one, I had no idea that 6 years later she would have 11 books, and she was just on the program last week because we were talking about her book called See Something. And, when you've done that, it's terrific. So I can see that I'm going to have you back quite often. and we will keep talking about coffee and about you're a really fine writer. And I really appreciated that as I was reading it. You paint the picture of Portland, of the food carts, of the people, and very enjoyable reading.
Well, thank you. I'm really glad to know that you enjoyed Fresh Food Murder.
And do you have a website where you want people to go and find out more about you? Or
sure. It's emmelineduncan.com. If you sign up for my newsletter, I send out a new drink recipe every month. Sometimes it's coffee, but it's not always. Sometimes it'll be, they think my next, actually it's an alcoholic drink will be the drink of the month for June.
Oh, this is dangerous for me. have coffee combined with gin, because my favorite drink is gin and tonic, because I lived in England for many years, and we would wait every afternoon. In those days, the pubs weren't open at lunch. After lunch, they closed down, and then they didn't open back up until 5:30 in the afternoon. And we'd wait outside the pub for that first gin and tonic. But to mix, I had never thought to mix gin and coffee. So I don't know. I might have something new here.
Yeah, I think I'll give you a little spoiler. The June drink of the month will actually be with using fresh lemons and whiskey.
Oh, boy.
But no coffee this month. But I also am debating doing soon a homemade, like, ginger tea latte, which will be very easy to make at home. Will also be a future drink.
Well, I think, people, you should go to Emmeline Duncan's website and sign up for that newsletter and get her recipes. And I'm sure that you're also on, what are you, on Facebook, Instagram?
Yeah, I'm on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Instagram is probably my favorite of the three, although no, you'll see a lot of photos of my Great Pyrenees if you follow me.
Okay.
So if you like big white dogs, it's a fantastic feed. And like I said, I do enjoy Twitter, and then I do have a Facebook page. And yeah, please follow me.
Okay, well, the name of the book is called Fresh Brewed Murder, and you're right, it looks so pretty on the cover, bright yellow cover, a really, really beautiful job by Kensington, and it's the first in a new series that I predict we will have many, many books to come, and Emmeline, you will be back with me every time, because I'm always ready to talk about coffee. Again, thank you for joining me today on Joy on Paper. I started my morning off at 5 o'clock this morning with a cup of coffee. And my biggest thing is I need a coffee sponsor here for Joy on Paper, because I will drink coffee on air to anybody who wants to sponsor me, because I go through a lot of coffee every day.
Well, thank you so much for having me on.
And how did you, I just want to ask, what was it like to be in Finland? Was it fun?
I loved it. I was actually an exchange student in high school, although, like I said, I am part Finnish. I did meet some kind of extended family. And so I was 16, and I was in a mining village of about 7,000 people in the middle of the country.
Wow.
And you might think 7,000, that's small. It's actually bigger than my hometown. So, I played Finnish baseball, and we traveled all over sort of central Finland in the second half of the year, and that was really fun. It was definitely very snowy, very dark in the winter, but, you know, I loved it.
And did you learn to speak Finnish?
And Pula is one of the best things ever.
So, how's your Finnish?
When I was there, I could actually get around speaking it pretty well, and sometimes it would take people a few sentences to even realize that I was American, because I somehow had a good accent. And then when I was in college here up in Oregon, I actually took Finnish for my foreign language credit, but most of my skills have definitely atrophied because I just don't have the chance to use it.
Okay, well, can you say goodbye to us in Finnish?
Oh, that's so funny. Hey, hey.
Hey, hey. That's exactly. I should have started the program by saying huvabaiva, because I didn't realize that you had been to Finland. So, okay.
I almost said that to you in Finnish, but then I didn't want to put you on the spot.
Well, my Finnish is rusty, too, but next time you're on the program, it's going to start with a huvabaiva, okay?
Sounds fantastic.
Okay. Hey, hey.
Okay.
Okay. Great talking to you. Okay. Emmeline Duncan, what a wonderful book called Fresh Brewed Murder, and it's available wherever books are sold. People, get it. It's lots of fun. And it is well worth the money. I'm telling you, people, it is really good. Okay, let's do a commercial, and then we'll be right back.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Are you an author? An artist? an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with my next guest, Susan McClelland. Oh, boy, she's not on yet. We're waiting for her. I thought she was on. Anyway, I'll talk a few minutes until she gets on, because she's supposed to be on. And it's a really great book, and I'm looking forward to talking to her. I think we have a number in case we have to call her. I know she's probably in California. This always happens with people who are far away. Although, you know, I think that Emmeline, I just spoke to Emmeline Duncan, and she is in Portland, Oregon, and she was up. So we'll see if we're going to have Susan on in a little while. Meanwhile, I'm just talk about one thing. I want to say one thing to all of you people. I get frustrated sometimes. If you are going to put a review on Amazon, think twice. Think twice about it before you say something or give a one star for really a ridiculous reason. Okay. All right. All right. I'm so happy now to welcome to Joy on Paper, Susan McClelland. She is the 2005 and 2009 winner of the Amnesty International Media Award. She has so many awards. I think it takes a whole page to list them all. But Susan McClelland is an amazingly talented journalist and writer. This book that I'm talking about today, it's very emotional for me because it is called Boy from Buchenwald, The True Story of a Holocaust Survivor. And it is by Robbie Weissman and, of course, Susan McClelland. Susan, thank you for joining me today on Joy on Paper.
Thank you for having me.
I will say this. This is, for me, a very emotional program. Because I have a feeling I am probably the only person who's interviewing you who has actually been to Skarzeszko Kamieniana. I was there. And I'm already starting to cry because we were there for the 50th anniversary of the Warsaw Ghetto uprising. We went to Zelazola Wola, which is where Chopin was born. And this village that we're going to be talking about today was about an hour and a half away from Zelazola Wola. And I was there. We were looking for my husband's family. From Lublin. His family was, mother's side of the family was from Lublin. We went to Lublin.
Okay.
We went to the ghetto. We went to other places in Poland. And we went to that village. And it's really hard for me because it brings back not just the memories of that, it brings back the memories of my husband's family. And people don't, I, I'm getting so crazy about anti-Semitism. And you're writing is this story that you've written with Robbie Weissman is written so, it's so beautiful. Your writing is incredible. You've taken this story and you're
going to make me cry. I've never cried in an interview before either.
And you moved it up a level beyond. It's not, I mean, I get a lot of Holocaust books, to tell you the truth. I could spend all my time reviewing Holocaust books. But what you've done with Robbie here, I'll let you explain his story.
Sure.
Because, it, as I said, for me, it's very emotional. I know this village.
I know
when you write about his mother, when you write about his father, about the chicken soup, about all of it, I was there, and I know what it was. I'll tell you something. There is no chicken soup better in the world than in Poland. I could not believe how wonderful it was when I got to Poland and we had chicken for the first time there. I said, my gosh, it's so good. It's so incredible. So I know this.
Without spoiling anything for the book, but Robbie ends up when he is in France. His name was Romic at that point. In France, being rehabilitated with the Ose. It was the chicken soup that was sort of the moment when he recognized someone he hadn't, the families didn't know each other, were still alive. That's my spoiler. But there's so much in the book that that little spoiler doesn't take away from anything. But yes.
Yeah. Well, explain first about the Jews in Poland. There were so many. There were so many.
Yes. And also, you know, Robbie still has a relative that is potentially missing, his young nephew. And, you know, there's no records as to where he went. He may have been with a farm. He may still even be alive and not even know he's Jewish. I mean, that was one of the problems with so many of the Jewish children that were able to survive by being hidden in convents, in Christian families, that after the war and the sheer numbers of dead, particularly Polish dead, Poland had the largest population of Jews in Europe. And the sheer numbers, many of these families said, you know, we're not going to tell this child who they are now because their relatives are all dead. I met Robbie about 5-6 years ago and instantly fell in love. I mean, he is the epitome of, I shall not hate, I will love. And when you say I took the book further, I'd like to just explain that his story of surviving in the Holocaust as a child, working for the munitions factory, escaping and being with the partisans for a while, all phenomenal. But what really struck me as a writer and a person was when Robbie would give his talks, you know, he's now 90, but before COVID, he was talking all over North America, all over the world. It was young people who were really gravitating to his story, wanting to know how he healed from all that. And what I just instantly drew to wasn't just Robbie's story, but was the OSE, this children's aid organization, that brought 427 of the Buchenwald boys to France, believing they could cure them. And just to give some back history, when the American armies liberated the Buchenwald concentration camp in Germany, they found approximately 1,000 boys under the age of 18, all orphans. The majority of them were orphans. Some of them, of course, did find relatives still alive afterwards. But hidden there by the Buchenwald camp underground resistance. And initially, these boys, you know, especially the ones from Poland who had a Holocaust experience for much, you know, for 5-6 years, they hadn't been in school. You know, Robbie lost his sense, didn't know where his family was. I mean, he had this dream. He was going to be running into his home saying, Mommy, I'm home. These boys, you know, they were starving, they were sick, they were feral, you know, they were eating with their hands, they were beating each other up. And experts who came to the camp really felt, you know, there's nothing can be done with these boys. You know, they're, whatever traumas, physical and emotional, spiritual, that they've experienced, they're never going to get over it. I think Robbie says he remembers someone saying they're not going to live past the age of 20. But whatever life they would have, it would not be a good life. But we know that's not true. And I really wanted to document in the book, in a literary way, for readers, for young readers, that healing journey of these boys that included Elie Wiesel, Chief Rabbi of Israel, an advisor for JFK, you know, but more importantly than the positions they had as global citizens, community organizers, they are family men, they are grandparents, and it's how. How did these boys, orphans from like the age of 9, 7, 6, surviving 5, 6 years, among men and skeletons and the Nazis, you know, as we say in the book, Robbie wasn't sure who was his friend or who was his foe that day. Like every single solitary second, it was on edge, you know, a constant PTSD of who's going to kill me today. And of course, in the book, we document the many times Robbie did skirt death. But the book is gets into Robbie's past of the Holocaust experience and his life in Kosciuszko, which was really a beautiful, very small, very orthodox but family life. But it's all woven around the years in France.
Well, of course, the years in the village, you know, until you've been there and you've, you know, walked in the village and you realize it must have been so lovely before the war. It must have been so lovely to be there. You would be able to walk out to the fields. You'd be able to walk out, and it's so beautiful. And as I said, Chopin was born, and his home is still a museum there in Zella Zolowola. And you go there, and it's so beautiful, and your heart is just filled with Chopin music, and it's so lovely, the countryside, as you're walking, and we took a lot of walks, and you know, because we were looking for cemeteries, to tell you the truth, but we walked, and it was so beautiful, and we were, because my son played several concerts for the ghetto uprising to raise money to preserve Jewish sites, and so he played with the symphony orchestra there, and so this beauty, when you see the beauty of it, and then you think, mm-hmm. How could it happen? How could all of a country filled with beautiful music in general, but particularly Chopin, how could it happen? And it's you wrote about this so beautifully, you know. And then of course we get from the camps, we get over to France. How did you work with Robbie on this? Did you? I don't know. It would be so emotional for me.
That's not my first book that I've worked on involving really extreme trauma. And so all my relationships with everyone I work ends up being really, really close and intimate. I went out to Robbie several times. He lives in Vancouver, Canada, and stayed with him and his wife, went through all their archives, spent hours and hours with Robbie, and sometimes at our breaks we would just drive, and it was so lovely. And you know, and I also fact checked the book with Dr. Kenneth Walzer at the University of Michigan. He had been studying the Buchenwald boys for decades as a historian, and particularly the Buchenwald camp resistance that ended up shielding these boys, which is like phenomenal. the risks that they took. And I also got original files from France, Robbie's original files, which also included some of his admissions to the camps, which were, I have to say, of everything in my career, as a hard document to look at and just have shivers move through me, were the actual, his camp, I don't know what you call it, inmate documents when they were imprisoning him. That was really very hard to look at. So it was just many, many hours with Robbie. He and then before we filed the book, I went out there and sat with him and his wife and for about over 3-4 days, read every line of the book and made even more changes from there. But it was working very closely with him, the relatives that were still alive, and people who knew his story, and Dr. Kenneth Walzer, and also Dr. Robert Quell. He is a psychiatrist at the University of British Columbia. He founded the Holocaust Center in Vancouver with Robbie. Dr. Quell is a hidden child, and his work as a psychiatrist has really looked at, some of his work has looked at how did these boys end up psychologically putting their experiences in some kind of context to be able to go out and do what they did in the world. And so I worked closely with him as well.
Well, of course, so many people, of course, have read Elie Wiesel's books. And yes. I just want to say that with your writing, which is it is incredible. Your writing is incredible. It's beautiful. Of course, as I said, you know, you are an award-winning journalist, and you've written, as you said, other books dealing with trauma, and you've gotten into the hearts and the minds of the people that you write about. I know I read The Bite of a Mango.
Yes.
Yeah.
That was my first book.
That was your first book?
I didn't know I was going to be a book writer until I wrote that book.
Wow. And that was incredible. I mean, that is an incredible book, too. And so I don't know how you're, well, you have to deal, too, with trauma here. And it's incredible what you've done.
Oh, thank you. I take it very seriously when subjects trust me with their story. And, you know, I hold that. I hold that as it's a great honor.
Well, and, you know, the thing with this book, now we're talking about something really horrific in many ways, in all ways, mm-hmm. but yeah. also in the writing, in the reading of the story, as it unfolds, as you take us into the story, and you take us into the getting to know some of the people, some of the really good people who were involved yes. in saving these boys from Buchenwald. It's so heartwarming, and it's so uplifting. And,
yes. and it's also comical, because remember, some of these were murderers. Like that guy, Gustav was the big thug. Like, he was the executioner of Buchenwald, you know. He was Polish-Jewish. I'm not sure if he was Jewish, but he was Polish. And when the train started coming in from Poland, you know, at the end of World War, near the end, the Nazis wanted to get rid of their evidence of what they'd done in Poland. And so they were sending Jews on death marches. They were starting to destroy Auschwitz and the other camps. And because Robbie had worked in a munitions factory, he was a worker for the Nazis, a slave laborer. Some of the boys that could still work and the men and families, they were being shipped to camps in Germany. And that's how these 1,000 boys, and there were more than that. Some of them did end up being killed at Buchenwald. But when the boys started arriving at Buchenwald, the resistance began to take them and said, you know, this is going to be our legacy. We're going to make sure that these boys survive. And they really played a game with, according to Dr. Walzer, you know, they played a game with the Nazis, saying we're going to teach these boys to be good German Nazis. And, you know, some of these boys, they had, because the resistance, you know, Buchenwald was the size of a small city. The Nazis couldn't control it. So they had formed partnerships with the resistance, not knowing it was the resistance, it was the communist underground, to do things, including meet the trains, and they would change, you know, the ID numbers of the boys and make them children of Christian communists. And, you know, they would hide them in places like even the brothels. And but some of the people that were overseeing this, they were real thugs too, like Gustav. If trains came in and it turned out that there was like a capo on the train or someone who had killed Jews, they would hold an internal camp sort of jury, and Gustav allegedly and another guy would go and kill them if found guilty. So it's like these big thugs are caring for these boys.
Well, as you write the story, and it's exactly these little vignettes, these little stories that make the book so fascinating. And I mean, I hate to say an easy read, but a read that you're reading, you're caught up in the story, you want to know more, you want to know what happens. And so I just want to thank you so much for being on the program today. And the book is called A Boy from Buchenwald, The True Story of a Holocaust Survivor. And it's by Robbie Weissman and Susan McClellan. Susan, you did a terrific job taking this story and just bringing it to a level of just absolute, it's a little literary masterpiece. It is so terrific.
Thank you. That is beautiful. Thank you.
And of course, you have a website. People can go there and see more about you. It's Susan McClellan, right? Is your website?
Yes. Susan, my website is S. McClellan.
Oh, S. McClellan. Yes, I remember now. S. McClellan. Make sure that you go there. You can check out her other books. As a matter of fact, Susan, I'm going to send you an invitation. I would love for you to come back on and talk about your other books.
Sure.
Particularly, I really enjoyed the story, or the Mango book, and I will have you back. But I want to play for you. This is part of what my son played in in Warsaw and in Wrocław, where we were, and he played with the symphony orchestra there, and it's just overwhelming, the emotion that I feel today with this story, and you brought this out, and I just want to say a special thank you to Robbie for doing this book, because I think it's an important book. So we're going to play this song on the way out. I'm sure if you listen to it, it'll move you too, because knowing that this concert that my son gave was to raise money for preserving the whole of Poland. Okay?
Beautiful. Thank you.
Bye-bye, Susan.
Bye-bye.